and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and we are here today to talk mitigating climate change, improving relations between the developed world and the developing world, and making the best use of our planet's natural resources. I am joined by Jeremy Zettelmeyer, Bruegel's director, and Ben McWilliams, one of our research fellows, to talk about a really important research project on how to work on these issues, and specifically one element of that on clean energy. Jeremy, can you tell us a bit about the broader report that this is part of?
Yes. So the report deals with climate action, so emissions mitigation, and also with nature preservation. These two things are closely linked because very often nature-based so-called carbon sinks help suck out carbon from the atmosphere, and you can create markets that help do this and in a sense serve dual purposes. So these two themes are linked. So the report deals with how to accelerate a good policy, particularly in emerging markets and developing countries, and what the EU and other industrial countries can do to help. And the context is one where we are trying to address two big, big complications. So one, in a sense, is pretty old, which is this notion that emerging markets and developing countries, they need to grow, they have poverty issues, and for the most part, you know, growth historically has been associated with much higher emissions because you need more energy, and for the most part, you produce this energy using polluting industries. And so the question is how to get emerging markets and developing to switch their energy sources and be able to grow without polluting so much, because that's the real key to bending down the global emissions curve. So the big emission rises are in emerging market and developing countries. At this point, China is the single biggest polluter. But at the same time, the per capita emissions levels in developing countries are still much lower. And of course, they didn't cause climate change. We caused it. And so this is a very sensitive, very difficult political issue. It's economically difficult, morally, politically. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is that we are seeing less willingness in the developed world, in the advanced countries, to tackle even their own emissions problems, let alone help the developing countries, right? And so, of course, the biggest manifestation of this problem right now is the turnaround of the United States, with the Trump administration basically saying, we're going to ignore climate change as a policy problem. And so can you find solutions that address both of these problems? So that's the big question, and it's very hard. But we have, you know, many chapters, we have many good authors, and so collectively we try to work on it.
Super. So Ben, you've been working particularly on this chapter about clean energy and how places that have renewable energy maybe can make things where energy costs are lower than they are in Europe. Walk us through what the problem is and then tell us your recommendations for addressing it.
I'm not sure it's a problem. It's more a way of looking at how a future energy system might look like and what are different comparative advantages, to use the technical economic word for it, in that future system. Today, it's pretty obvious. Some countries have oil and gas in the ground and some countries don't. And those who have oil and gas in the ground are well placed to export it, and those who don't must import it. In the future, it's going to look different. If we assume a largely renewable energy dominated world, let's take that assumption for now. Theoretically, it's possible to produce renewable energy anywhere in the world, as long as you install the correct facility. There is still some comparative advantage, though, because some places are more sunny and windier than other places. And also there's greater space availability, greater land availability in some places, which is really a challenge that we're starting to see in Europe, with lots of people pushing back against big wind turbines or solar farms being built in their local area. So in the future, we're not going to see the same pressure. It's not that one country is going to export all of their energy or have the pressure to export all of their renewable energy, but they will have a slightly better position. Big problem is, maybe there is a problem, big problem is it's a lot more expensive to transport renewable energy, electricity, we typically think of it as. It's a lot more expensive to transport this than it is crude oil, which you lump on a ship and transport it at really, really low, essentially insignificant cost. Now, that leads us, and also many people growing in literature, to come to the conclusion we're all on now, which is that there will be a pressure for producing things which take a lot of energy and are easily tradable. So, the energy you need for driving your car and heating your home, you need to produce that locally. You need to have the electrons there physically to use them. But if we're talking about some industrial processes, particularly industrial processes which kind of just require pouring energy in, things like making aluminium, making ammonia, that requires a lot of energy to be put in, and you end up with this quite stable commodity, which actually in many cases is widely traded today. So that's kind of where the chapter gets at. We can get into the details, but that's where the chapter gets at, is there's going to be a significant pressure for the trade in so-called energy intensive goods. And rather than being a problem, it can actually be quite a liberating thing for European industry and green European industry. The ability to move some of these products around and get them into places like the Ruhr Valley in Germany, which would then allow other value chain stages to remain there.
If I can add, our big fear in Europe is deindustrialization. And there are essentially two reasons behind that fear. One, frankly, is China, which produces a lot of the things that we used to produce more cheaply and in greater quantities. And, maybe some of that is permanent, and then maybe it's a good thing, at least globally. So if we keep doing other stuff, we can just buy their stuff. There is an issue of economic security, of course, but maybe that can be addressed by not becoming overly dependent. But some of it may also be temporary, and then we want to keep some industry in case we need it in the future. But the second element of that problem is our high energy costs. And so I think the premise of our chapter is to say, look, best as we can tell, the high energy cost problem is not going to go away, even after we are through with our energy transition. And the reason is that our renewables energy resources are not as abundant as in countries where there's more sun and more wind. Nuclear can kind of make up for some of that, but even nuclear is quite expensive, and it's not popular in dense areas and so forth. And so, the basic point in our chapter is to say, look, the way to address this problem is by actually being quite positive on the prospect of quote unquote losing or outsourcing some energy intensive production stages, because by doing that, you can keep the rest. Not only can you keep the rest, but you're going to lower energy demand. And in the context of a continent with limited energy supply, lowering energy demand means you're going to lower energy prices. And that's going to make the rest of industry more competitive. That is the essential argument of the paper. So let's sort of, in a sense, embrace this problem, but deal with it in a nuanced way. Rather than to resist all change, let's sort of strategically pick the commodities, the energy intensive intermediate inputs, where it's really inefficient to do it in Europe. And let's actually promote the production of these elsewhere as an alternative to having to import the energy directly. So rather than importing the energy, we import these energy intensive goods, thereby making the further downstream stages of energy intensive industry, like the actual steel production, more competitive and also lowering energy demand and hence energy prices.
The next part of the podcast, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the dependence that you guys raised. It seems to make a lot of sense to me to make the stuff that's very energy intensive in places where energy is cheap and then move that to the places where everything else is going to be put together. But that does create the idea that there could be supply chain bottlenecks or even just disruptions that aren't anybody's fault, like the COVID pandemic or the blocked canal. Ben, how do you account for that in your model of how to move forward? And is that just kind of the way to make the most of the resources we have, or are there other options?
I think the place to begin is what's the counterfactual? And if we take today's counterfactual, that's everything is imported. All of our natural gas, all of our oil, not just for producing energy intensive products, but for driving our cars and heating our homes, it's all imported. And all from one, typically a few different places around the world. And we've seen the risks of that over the last couple of years. So, without wanting to diminish the risk, because this is, there is an economic security concern, there is an argument here, and it should be thought through. But the starting place is this is a far better world for Europe, not just from economic efficiency, but from economic security than it is today. And then getting into the specifics, it's not that, and it wouldn't be advisable that you go to Chile and produce an incredible amount of land and do everything in one part of Chile. Clearly, that would not be sensible. If there's a political risk or a natural risk, there'd be big problems. So, you know, the typical economic security advice holds that you would want to look both to import from a diversified pool of suppliers, but also to keep some domestic production. You know, you can have this discussion, what's the correct level? It is almost certainly sensible to do some of this within Europe, and you want to exploit that. And even within Europe particularly, you know, the focus of our chapter is on the Global South and the Global North. Our chapter particularly, Global South and Europe. It's also the case that within Europe, you can think of some of these distributional effects that, for example, places like the Iberian Peninsula with very good solar availability, or some Northern European countries with very good hydro, could also be having these clusters. So I think the way, if I think we use the term central planner in our paper, which is not possible, but if we were, or at least I was, central planner, you'd imagine this sort of amalgamation of quite a bit in the Global South, but then quite a bit spread around Europe. And even in places like Germany, maybe some domestic capacity, just 10, 20%, such that you retain skills and know-how and you keep on the R&D frontier. But in this way, you mitigate the security risk.
Super interesting. Does this require upgrades to Europe's infrastructure to make it work? I suppose we need to do that under any circumstance, but I'm thinking particularly with renewables, they create different stresses on the power grid than one we've seen before. And maybe this doesn't work unless we make those changes first. What do you think?
In general, yes. But actually, perhaps why this route is a little bit attractive is because it requires far less infrastructure upgrades. Here we're talking about transporting products which are already transported today. There's a lot of ammonia ships in circulation today. There's a lot of iron ships in circulation today. It'll be a tiny bit different product, but very similar. So actually, it's kind of an infrastructure light approach, and infrastructure might be a reason why this makes a lot of sense. In, you know, a few years ago in Brussels, a big debate was on this hydrogen backbone, which is this idea that we're going to have pipelines like we have natural gas today, pumping hydrogen around the continent. Might still happen, but I think if you speak to anybody in the space, they'd be quite disappointed with the progress. It's not moving forward as we would have expected. And if you have these infrastructure bottlenecks and it's difficult to build hydrogen pipelines to take hydrogen from Spain to Germany, to use the same example, the inevitability is this creates a larger economic pressure for finding another way to move the hydrogen. And another way to move the hydrogen is, let's put it into something energy intensive, put that on a ship, which we already have today, and send that to a port in Germany, which already exists today, and use all the facilities that exist today. So I actually think for this particular niche, I mean, generally, the shift to renewables definitely requires huge infrastructure investment. But this particular niche, I actually think is quite infrastructure light.
If I can just add to that. So when it comes to the question of whether to import energy or to make it at home, there is arguably a trade-off between efficiency, you know, cost and security, right? We could really push energy production through renewables at home, and then, you know, we would have to build bigger grids, we would have to put in more storage if this is going to be renewables, but we would be more self-sufficient. When it comes, however, to raw material, there is typically no such trade-off, or much less so, because we are going to need to import iron one way or the other. And so the idea here is that if we need to import iron anyway, we might as well import this in a bundle with energy by importing direct reduced iron rather than iron ore, right? And so in that respect, there is zero trade-off. We are not going to become more dependent on anyone by just switching the commodity that we import and switching into a more energy intensive, further downstream version of the commodity. Right? So there is actually not much of a trade-off there. In other goods, there may be, but it is far less a choice between efficiency and economic security than you might think at first blush.
Thanks. One of the things I wanted to come back to is this idea of how you get political buy-in from the Global South. You mentioned in your opening remarks, German, that we can't just pin it on them to fix a problem that the developed world has played the biggest role in creating. So how do we do this in a way that respects the autonomy of these countries and that helps them provide for their own citizens as well as our supply chain?
So I think that, you know, in a sense, selling this to the Global South is easier than selling this to some of our constituencies. Like with our constituencies, like I said, there's a fear that, you know, we are going to start some sort of cascading process of deindustrialization by starting to offshore some production stages, maybe others will follow. And we are saying, No. I mean, we have control over this, and there are big differences between these production stages. Let's just focus on a few that are really energy intensive in order to save the rest, if you like. With respect to the global south, again, there is a little bit of an issue of the counterfactual. The idea that we would want to support them in making stuff industrial in their countries is, of course, very much in line with their own developing models, right? And here, our interest is mainly in where there might be a conflict of interest that we really, really want them to do it in a green way. So we do not want this whole thing to just to lead to carbon leakage by having, stuff that was previously produced with emissions in the north now being produced with a lot of emissions in the south. So we want to teach them to do it in a green way. And so, there's going to be a conflict there because that then involves them shutting down some of the carbon intensive energy production. But in principle, this is about accelerating a green industrial model in the south, which requires two things. It would require, as a first step, and maybe the most important step, greening the energy system in the south. And then, as an added step, greening the production processes that lead to the production of these energy intensive inputs. They're going to need financing for both of that. We're going to have to offer some of those financing. And basically, what we argue is that this is going to still be still a lot cheaper than trying to subsidize green production in the EU, where it's relatively less competitive.
What do you think, Ben?
I think there's, in terms of the risks to think about, the one obvious one that people will always raise is that of cannibalizing green energy supply. So the idea that if you go in and you're building your green energy export plants, that you're taking away solar and wind that could have gone to local communities, which is not a fresh issue. It's been there for a while, and there are ways to think about this. It shouldn't be ignored. On the other hand, if you go in and do this and you start building green energy export plants for Europe, where the demand is today, where the demand does not exist in many of these countries, and to be frank, they're not so keen for the demand to exist there yet. They're kind of 10 years behind in this space, and for many reasons, Europe is ahead, and Europe is the one who's building these green lead markets. So in many ways, this positive spillover can exist whereby once you build your first green iron export plant, which you would not have been able to build for the domestic market, simply nobody would pay the premium at the beginning. Once you've built the first one, it takes a few years to get up, you train the engineers, et cetera, et cetera. Building the second and third one in 2030, 2035 for your domestic market and also for other export markets around the world suddenly becomes a lot easier. So, as always, positive and negative trade-offs that need to be managed.
And do you see political support as available for this, or are there really a lot of legacy industries that will just be scared of this kind of change?
I think even the words deindustrialization and outsourcing, we can do the control F how many times you've said, probably try to avoid saying it, because as soon as you say those words, then your presentation's over, nobody listens to you. But I do think that there's even within industry a growing sense that this is going to make sense and is going to happen. And I think it's because the economics are starting to bite. Now in Europe, with the introduction of the carbon border mechanism, and what that really importantly means is that we get rid of free allowances for heavy industry in Europe. So finally, they pay a real carbon price. So the economics are starting to bite. They're starting to have to invest in these things. And we are starting to see these themes whereby investments are shifting to these places. To give you one example, ArcelorMittal, the big steel producer, they haven't made their final decision yet, as far as I understand, but they are heavily exploring the idea of producing what Jeremy mentioned, direct reduced iron outside of Europe and then importing it to their European plants. So there's always pushback, but I think even within industry, this idea is starting to gain weight.
In the last section of today's podcast, I'd like to talk about the policy changes needed to make this happen and also the money. German, is there funding needed either to help these supply chains get started in the developing world or to help Europe make the transition? Or what's the investment necessary to get this going?
Yeah, so there is less funding needed than in the counterfactual of, trying to take a whatever it takes approach to preserving energy intensive industry in Europe, but there's still some funding needed. So basically, the way to think about this is there are two ways in which you can support energy intensive industry in Europe. The one is through free allowances. So this is essentially free permits to emit. And so these free allowances are supposed to be phased out once the so-called carbon border adjustment mechanism, which charges other countries for importing or exporting steel and heavy industry products that would be subject to the emissions trading system in Europe. Once that's up and running, the idea is we will have a level playing field between, at least what the European market is concerned, between these foreign companies and our own, and then we can phase out those allowances. And that should go ahead. But to the extent that we delay to give some of our energy intensive industry more time to adapt, the future supply of free allowances should be linked to abatement efforts, right? So we should only do it to the extent that actually they are on a green transition path. Now, that does not yet get into the issue of subsidies for capital expenditures or even possibly for operational expenditures. And so, the main point of our paper is to say that to the extent that you want to go a step further and actually subsidize the capacity for energy intensive products in Europe directly, not just through free allowances, you should only do it for those stages of production that are further downstream and comparatively less energy intensive. You should not try to actively lean against the outsourcing of these super energy intensive production stages, right? That is our main sort of domestic policy implication. And that is something new. So this is not a point that you find in any commission document, as far as I understand. You do not find it in the Draghi report. So the Draghi report, breaks with tradition by saying, look, we cannot just give them money conditional on some CapEx, but we should condition it on abatement efforts, which is good, but it's not enough. We, in addition, need to discriminate between, I think, those production stages that we think are going to be competitive in the long term and those that are not. Those are the energy intensive ones, and we should not subsidize the latter. And so that is our main point as far as, the Clean Industrial Deal is concerned and domestic EU policy is concerned. And then, of course, there's the dimension of what we do with the developing countries, but that's probably a separate question.
So just to be clear, this investment you're talking about, this is in subsidies and aid to parts of the European supply chain?
Yes, what I've just talked about is the subsidies to the parts of the European supply chain. And so the big difference in our philosophy and the prevailing one is the emphasis on the word parts.
Let's come back then to the carbon border adjustment mechanism, because that obviously is the connection or part of the connection between the EU supply chain and supply chains in the rest of the world. So tell us again, how does that fit in?
So the carbon border adjustment mechanism should go ahead either way, but it's not going to be enough as an instrument of industrial policy, and it is not viewed as the only instrument, right? So if we could have a purely carbon price, carbon border adjustment based climate and energy policy, but we don't. And the reason is that we think that we will likely deindustrialize too quickly, particularly in light of the fact that our energy costs are so high, if we only focus on one problem, which is to reduce abatement, right? So there's this so-called hard to abate industries where the cost of abatement is very high. And so the worry, the reason why this is given so much prominence, for example, in the Draghi report, is that if we simply allow these price-based mechanisms to operate, the ETS, supported by the carbon border adjustment mechanism, the carbon border adjustment mechanism by itself is not going to be powerful enough to lean against rapid deindustrialization of energy-intensive industry, simply because energy is going to be really expensive here. And so there is effectively consensus that we need to buffer the industrial transformation process in Europe in a way that supports or protects parts of this industry. And we are part of that consensus. We are not completely outside this consensus. We are just making the point like, hey guys, be careful what you subsidize. Don't subsidize stuff that is super energy intensive and easy to trade. Because having that outside Europe may actually be a benefit to the rest of our industry And in addition, of course, subsidizing this stuff is going to be really costly, and we also have a fiscal problem, right? So we want a more intelligent, more focused industrial policy that allows structural change to happen that we view as inevitable in the longer run.
Ben, can you connect this to some of the other work you've done at Bruegel, particularly on solar panels, and how you've worked on projects, if I remember, that recommend the EU be smarter about how it manages its solar deployment strategy rather than just trying to do everything in-house and spending tons of money on it?
Yeah, I guess the link is to the Net Zero Industry Act, which is somewhat seen as the EU's response or the European Commission's response to the Inflation Reduction Act in America, which was coming forward with huge subsidies across the board for clean tech deployment and manufacturing in America. Maybe it's not going to exist much longer, but that, back in 2022, that was the case. And the one thing that I think many colleagues at Bruegel and probably around Europe share was a big problem with this document and this ambition was the blanket target that the EU would produce 40% of all its clean tech individually. So 40% of its solar panels, 40% of its wind turbines, 40% of its heat pumps, et cetera, which doesn't make much sense from an economic efficiency standpoint because the EU is good at doing some things, not good at doing other things because of a variety of long-standing reasons and structural reasons. And I think that again holds here. It's about this. I mentioned it earlier. The technical term is the comparative advantage. And if you want to deploy effective industrial policy and shift around your resources within your economy, if you kind of try and do this against the way in which the economy is pushing you, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be expensive, and it might work. You might be able to break it and break out in some new way, but it's unlikely to work. It's less likely to work. So I think it goes back to this word "smart," which is a bit easy to say, but it goes back to that and. As the EU, along with it seems much of the world, now shifts back into an era of doing industrial policy, it needs to be done in an effective way and trying to exploit these advantages. And our main argument here is that, as Jeremy has said, this notion of parts, that it's about not thinking of steel. We talk about steel. Who's going to make steel? It's pretty complex. If you try and get into it, you lose 2 weeks of your life, but try to read the steel value chain and how it's made and how it's produced, and it's hundreds of different processes that are going on. And in the same way that they were forged over 100 years and moved around the world because of different comparative advantages, the same thing or the same pressure is going to happen in the future as we shift to green energy. Question for governments is, how do they live with that pressure and manage the kind of societal consequences?
What concretely are the next steps you'd like to see the Commission take?
There's a couple of two policies to add on what Jeremy was discussing on not being overly protectionist. I think there's two quite exciting policies which are already in place. One at European level, which is the Hydrogen Bank. Now, the Hydrogen Bank so far has had two auctions for domestic production of hydrogen, typically hydrogen becoming one of the ammonia, methanol, reduced anodes we've discussed today, which have gone pretty well and bids have been quite competitive. There's the ambition in there for an international arm. And I think in DG Clima, they're already thinking along these lines. But I think what it would be nice to see there is that this international arm is really thinking about the concept of these intermediate products. So it's not about importing hydrogen, which is going to be too expensive typically. It's about importing ammonia and methanol and direct reduced iron. And through this vehicle, where the DG Clima has a pot of money and it's able to give some subsidies for this trade, going and discussing with partners around the world on how this might work and how they might set this up. That's at the European level. And from Germany, there's another quite exciting policy called H2 Global, which plans a double auction mechanism. So suppliers around the world can bid in for how cheap they could send hydrogen to Germany and demand off takers in Germany bid how much, and the government subsidizes the difference. The fingers like this, but you can't see on a podcast when I said hydrogen, because that's the big question I would think is this. Should not only be thinking about hydrogen, and there's already language in the documents there to this extent. This should be thinking about ammonia, methanol, direct reduced iron, how you get these cheaply into German ports and then distribute them to your suppliers. And both of these policies exist, and they've already passed through this 3 year cycle of legislation. So it's quite exciting that they could and will be up and running pretty quickly.
Super. I also thank you for the first use of air quotes on a podcast in my era. It shows how innovative we're trying to be and how many new ideas we're bringing to the table. Chairman, what do you want to see the commission do with these recommendations and in what time period?
I would like, if you like, a reformulation or a specialization of the Clean Industrial Deal that essentially differentiates industrial support subsidies according to the energy intensity of production stages, and so not just according to abatement efforts. So, in principle, there are subsidies out there that have been earmarked for energy-intensive industry. I think something in the order of 100 billion at the level of the Commission, and then there's, of course, additional money at the member state level. And so I want essentially a change in the approach of how this money would be dispersed. And then the other important part deals with policies towards developing countries. And there, basically, we need three things to happen to make this vision become a reality. The first is the decarbonization of energy sectors. Now, that is really critical anyway, regardless of this whole, reallocation of production in some industries from north to south. And so, in my view, and we have argued this with my co-authors Patrick Bolton and Alyssa Kleinein, who's in a recent Bruegel blog, we should go out there and offer much higher volumes of conditional financial support for countries that want to do this. And we could do this in the context of COP30 before countries come up with their new so-called nationally determined contributions, right? So their plans for decarbonization. So we should invite so-called conditional NDCs that say, look, if the EU and other donors are willing to support us, we are willing to go much faster on energy sector decarbonization. So this is an independent point, but it is a necessary step for what we have in mind. Because the two other steps that are required for our vision to become real is that you're going to need a lot of domestic electricity, particularly to produce hydrogen, green hydrogen, locally. Because that's then the key ingredient that you need for some of these industrial processes, particularly direct reduced iron. And rather than shipping this hydrogen to us, they should use it locally to produce DRI. And for that, they will need presumably additional investment support. So that's stage two. And stage three is going to be some sort of trade arrangement that facilitates the importation of these goods into the EU. Now, the nice thing is that the Commission is, I think, sort of on this bit pretty much aligned with us because they've already come up with what they call a new instrument in April called the Clean Trade and Investment Partnerships. And they are supposed to be these mini trade deals that, in a sense, combine market access for some of these products with investment support. And I think that's a nice framework to actually organize the type of cooperation that we want to see. Ben, do you have anything to add on this one?
Not particularly. I think the CTIPs, Clean Trade and Investment Partnerships, seem to be the interesting space which von der Leyen has mentioned and gives the possibility for going and negotiating some of these agreements. And I think with South Africa is the ongoing one. How do you try to go with South Africa and persuade that it makes sense for them to invest in this? And you enter into this kind of, should be a win-win partnership where both are getting something from this. It's not about going and giving development aid or going and giving just support for decarbonization, but it's also for the EU about going and deploying things and building things, which gives something back in return for the EU, and hopefully gives South Africa or whichever country in the future you negotiate with this push also to industrialize in a green manner.
There's a bit of a trade-off, I think, between, creating expectations of steady demand for these products, so like offtake agreements, and subsidizing the supply, right? So the more we can create a framework where it is clear that European industry will actually be a customer for those cleanly produced intermediate products, the less do we need to help these countries which are actually building the capacity to produce them.
Small point here, it's a working hypothesis, but I mentioned the hydrogen bank in the EU, and there's now been two auctions in this hydrogen bank, and the bids have cleared at very low levels, surprisingly low levels, even within the EU. And a working hypothesis is because the EU here has approached this with very similar to what German outlines, a dual approach. One, bringing subsidies, but two, bringing regulation that demands that I think it's two-fifths of hydrogen consumed in Europe by 2030 must be green. So now industry, it's not coming with a subsidy and saying, we give you the subsidy if you want to do this. It's saying, by the way, guys, you have to do this anyway. And now we come and give you the subsidy. And now you bid against each other and see who comes with the cheapest price. And I think that dual approach is very important for maximizing the effectiveness of subsidies, which, I mean, to be frank, that the you know, we're not sitting on a lot of money that's free to spend. So that's super important.
Excellent points. The report that we've been discussing will be available on our website, Bruegel.org, along with all of our other work on solar panels, on hydrogen, on the Clean Industrial Deal. Those of you who are interested in this, very much encourage you to poke around, and we'll list a few in the show notes. Before we go, Ben and Jeremy, do you have any other chapters in the Paris Report you'd like to call out very briefly as maybe a particular interest to people who've enjoyed this podcast?
Oh yeah, I mean there are some super other chapters. So there's a very important chapter written by some American colleagues of ours, a team led by Kim Clausing of UCLA and Catherine Wolfram of MIT, with some Harvard co-authors, and they advocate essentially a plurilateral international version of the CBAM, including both advanced and developing countries, where within that set of countries, there would be no carbon border adjustment, but there would be an external carbon border adjustment collective to this group. And the condition for entering this is that you have some form of carbon pricing, but that carbon price could be differentiated based on stage of development. So you encourage carbon pricing, and if countries agree to that, you let them off the hook as far as having to pay a CBAM to the EU is concerned. So this is a very key chapter. We have a very important chapter by Ottmar Edenhofer, the director of the Potsdam Climate Institute, talking about carbon reduction. So markets to actually extract for extracting carbon from the atmosphere rather than just charging emissions. So he believes quite strongly that we cannot do everything with emissions mitigation. There will likely be an overshoot. And so we need to create price-based incentives to actually reduce the carbon in the atmosphere. We have another important chapter on the design and scaling up of nature-based markets, written by my co-editor of the report, Beatrice Veda Di Mauro, who is also the president of CEPR, with Estelle Cantillon from the Free University of Brussels, Université Libre de Bruxelles, and Eric Lambin, who is at Louvain and Stanford and is an economic geographer. So it's an interdisciplinary team. And they talk about essentially reshaping markets for nature conservation. And their key idea here is that rather than paying for offsets or paying for investment in nature that will reduce emissions by a certain amount, you pay for claims like equity on a future stream of these carbon reducing investments. So you essentially buy a share of a project that you think is going to lead to these things down the road. And the big difference with what's happening now is that by doing that, you have an interest in protecting that investment and that project, rather than just taking a particular offset and running with it, and then not worrying about the fact that the forest that you have just helped to grow might burn off in the next year. So that's another key chapter. And then finally, another chapter to highlight is the one with my co-authors, Patrick Bolton and Alyssa Klein-Nienhuys, that quantify the cost of eliminating or phasing out fossil fuels from the energy sectors in the developing world, including China, and building renewables instead of replacing them. And so these are very, very granular plant-based estimates. It's a really unique work. And basically, they make the point that if you exclude China, which is by far the biggest effort here, because they are already quite advanced in their energy systems, except they are mostly, of course, polluting. If you just take India and all the other developing countries, then the costs of funding that, assuming some blend of private and public funding, the cost for the public sector is quite manageable. So it would be about between 0.2 and 0.3% of GDP per year in the next 10 years of the GDP of the developed world, of the advanced countries. If we take out the US, because the US is unlikely to be part of any climate finance coalition in the foreseeable future, it would rise to something like 0.3%. And they argue that the economic benefits to this funding coalition of advanced countries vastly outweigh the costs, because most of the cost of the economic cost of climate change will be borne by the countries with the biggest GDPs that have the most to lose. So it's essentially an argument to say, look, guys, it's in your economic self-interest to do some of this funding, provided we can create a governance structure that the actual actions, right, the phasing out of fossil energy sources happens, right, which is tricky, but that's the plea.
So, yeah, go find all those chapters. They will be listed collectively and separately on our website, Bruegel.org. You've been listening today to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel. I'm Rebecca Christie, joined today by Jeremy Zettelmeyer and Ben McWilliams. Thank you so much, and see you next time.